Welcome to the Federalist Society's Practice Group podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federalist Society's International and National Security Law Practice Group, was recorded on Thursday, March 9, 2017, during a live telephone conference call held exclusively for Federalist Society members. Welcome to the Federalist Society's telephone conference call. This afternoon, we'll hear the last installment of our Security Partnership telephone series, this one on foreign government partnerships. My name is Laura Flint. I'm the Deputy Director of Practice Groups at the Federalist Society. As always, please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the experts on today's call. Today, we are happy to have with us Ambassador Ryan C. Crocker, Dean of the Bush School of Government and Public Service at Texas A&M University, William K. Lietzau, Vice President of Governance and Institutional Development at PAE, Sally A. Schwartz, Partner at Artis Wise, and our moderator, Adam Perlman, Special Advisor to the International and National Security Law Practice Group. I will turn it over to Adam Perlman to get us started. After opening remarks, we'll go to audience question and answer. Thank you for speaking with us, Adam. The floor is yours.
Well, thank you, Laura, and good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to the third and final installment of this teleforum series on security partnerships. I will begin this call in my normal fashion, which is to note that any views I might express today are mine alone and do not necessarily reflect the policy or position of the Department of Defense or any agency of the United States government. In our first two calls, we explored the contours of information sharing among federal, state, and local authorities for counterterrorism purposes and between public and private entities to counter cyber threats. In today's teleforum, we will return to the arena of counterterrorism to discuss the benefits, limits, and dynamics of partnerships with foreign government agencies in defeating asymmetric or non-state actors and how actions taken consistent with those goals may have wider foreign policy implications. Now, by way of background and framing today's discussion, historically, protecting national security meant protecting one's own citizens and sovereign territory from the threats or opposing interests of other nation states. The concept has broadened, however, as transnational terrorists act with unprecedented scale and range. The threats they pose are of a magnitude previously only possible for nation states, and they act indiscriminately among the several countries they feel justified in attacking. The United States' interest in defeating these actors, then, is one that is shared by many other countries, some of which are not necessarily our allies in a larger sense. Today, we are pleased to have with us, as Laura said, Ambassador Ryan Crocker, Bill Lietzau, and Sally Schwartz. Sally Schwartz is a true international lawyer, even writing the book on careers in international law, which is currently in its fourth edition. A dual national of the United States and America's oldest ally, France, she earned her JD at Syracuse before starting her law practice in Paris in 1979. A founding partner at Artis Wise in Paris, the second law firm she helped found, her practice includes transnational business deals, international M&A, and corporate and commercial law. She counsels clients on issues related to the Foreign Corrupt Practices Act and anti-boycott laws, and has particular expertise in advising African governments negotiating extractive permits and agreements. She has spoken around the world on these and numerous other topics relating to development and security issues. I had the opportunity to sit on a panel with her last year in Rome on privacy and security, which we will touch on a bit today from a foreign affairs rather than legal angle. She's a former chair of the ABA section of international law and is a lifetime member of the Council on Foreign Relations. Bill Lietzau, Vice President of Governance and Institutional Development at PAE Systems, is the former Deputy Assistant Secretary of Defense for Rule of Law and Detainee Policy. His portfolio at DOD included policy related to the detention of enemy forces under international humanitarian law, including Guantanamo Bay detainees, as well as developing and coordinating global policy guidance relating to rule of law initiatives and capacity building in foreign countries. He served 27 years in the United States Marine Corps. After graduating from the United States Naval Academy and being commissioned as an infantry officer, he paused his military career to attend a small law school in New Haven, Connecticut. As a judge advocate, he served at various times as a prosecutor, defense attorney, military judge, and operational lawyer. He was also special advisor to the General Counsel of the Department of Defense, deputy legal advisor to the Chairman of Joint Chiefs of Staff, and deputy legal advisor to the National Security Council at the White House, retiring with the rank of colonel. For our third speaker, President George W. Bush called Ambassador Crocker America's Lawrence of Arabia. To put things into perspective, two-time ambassadors are rare, three-time ambassadors are exceptionally so. But between 1990 and 2012, Crocker served as U.S. ambassador to six countries: Lebanon, Kuwait, Syria, Pakistan, Iraq, and Afghanistan. His awards earned include the Presidential Medal of Freedom, and he even has one named for him, the Ryan C. Crocker Award for Outstanding Leadership in Expeditionary Diplomacy. Before all his time in the Middle East, he studied, of all things, English literature at Whitman College in Walla Walla, Washington, a small town that boasts at least one other phenomenal Foreign Service officer that I'm familiar with. He spent several years as dean of Texas A&M's Bush School and continues to serve the nation as a member of the Broadcasting Board of Governors. Now, I'm going to open the floor to our speakers to touch on different angles of this discussion that best match up with their respective experiences and expertise. Ambassador Crocker is America's chief diplomat in six countries that have been involved in some way in terrorism or counterterrorism matters. Li Tsao is someone who served in critical roles both in the formulation of U.S. counterterrorism detention policy after 9/11 and again several years later in dealing with allies and partner nations as a different administration took its own tack on detention and great attention was given to America's standing in the world. And Schwartz is an American lawyer on the ground in Europe with her finger on the pulse of allied reactions to reports of U.S. policies and operations, as well as those countries' own responses to terrorist attacks. To start off, Mr. Li Tsao, Bill, you dealt very specifically with one of the hottest, most controversial issues in U.S. national security for a long time, counterterrorism detention. This included things like the quagmire of Guantanamo at a time when a popular phrase was that America had diminished standing in the world. Did you find that to be true in a general sense, and how, if at all, was your job impacted on a day-to-day basis to the extent you needed to interact with foreign partners?
Thanks, Adam. And yeah, I'm happy to answer that. I think, in fact, in many ways, Guantanamo probably provides a good example of what can go wrong when we don't focus enough on the partnering we need to do with foreign governments on things with which we require cooperation. You've talked about Ambassador Crocker's past. He certainly was in a position where I'm sure he was called on to seek the cooperation of foreign governments. And there's no way for us to counter the transnational threats we have from terrorist organizations today without international cooperation. I think just by throughout my experiences in counter-terrorist related positions, I think it's been obvious that we've made mistakes in our partnering. For just by way of a quick example, in the early days, I was at the initial stages of setting up military tribunals where some of the alleged terrorists who'd been held at Guantanamo were going to be tried. This was years ago. They still are being. But at the time, one of the first things was to reach out to allied partners and secure evidence that could be used against them in trial. And because the United States had done not such a great job in explaining exactly what it was doing and how what it was doing was consistent with the rule of law and human rights, we were rebuffed on many occasions and not able to get the evidence that we needed. These are the kinds of things that have come back to haunt us over and over again. And I guess I don't want to capitalize too much of the conversation. I know we'll go back and forth, but I think my main point would be, while we have to be attuned to the relationships we have with foreign governments, at the same time, that doesn't mean we should simply react to them and react in such a way that appears to appease them. And I fear that. I think I saw it to some degree where I was in both the Bush and the Obama administrations, and to some degree you have just simply an attempt to do the opposite of what the previous administration did. And hopefully the new Trump administration will not just do that, because besides recognizing our relationships with allies, I think we also need to recognize that we are going to have to play a leadership role in this this fight against terrorism. And in that role, we need to be able to explain exactly how we're addressing the problems. And Guantanamo, again, serves as a very good example. We confused people by mixing a law enforcement tool of trials with a law of war tool of war-related detention. And to this day, when the press and our allies talk about Guantanamo, they often talk about how it's a legal black hole where people have been held for years without being charged or tried. And in fact, when you really look at the legal paradigm we put in place, it was one analogous to a prisoner of war situation where you wouldn't normally prosecute someone anyway. So I guess my main point would be being focused on those relationships is important, but had we simply reacted to what a lot of our allies thought was the right answer back in 2002, we would have been equally wrong. And so we have to really engage with them instead and try to get some clarity as to what the legal regime we're using is and how we're fighting this war.
Thanks, Bill. And Sally, you've been on the ground in Europe for a long time. And obviously, Guantanamo in 2002 is a great example of French and U.S. disagreement and other areas. Certainly the events leading up to the 2003 invasion of Iraq, and then later on, European criticism of U.S. surveillance programs when some of those came to light. But in the last couple of years, we've also seen brutal terrorist attacks in France, and we've seen the French take a very hard stand on the domestic counterterrorism front. Can you describe any changes in French law, policy, or attitude, and your thoughts about whether there might be inconsistencies, either historic or in real time, between European criticisms of U.S. actions and what our friends across the pond are willing to do for the sake of their own security? Sally, you might be muted.
Right, I am. Thank you. Is this good? Okay.
Yep.
I wanted to give a preface to my remarks in response to your very interesting question, Adam, which is, I think whatever criticisms come out of France, because I can't speak for every European country, and France tends to scream the loudest when it doesn't like what's going on, is some legal and societal background as compared to the United States. I think everyone should be aware of the fact that France does not have the same type of constitution. It does not have a Bill of Rights, and it doesn't have the First Amendment. And it has a very bad history that came out of the Algerian War with accusations of torture by the French troops there. So keeping that perspective in mind, France did elect, after a number of terrorist attacks, some very hard legislation, but it, compared to what was going on in its normal state of legislation, it wasn't actually that harsh. To give you an example, up until a few years ago, anyone that was accused of terrorism could be held for 4 days without access to a lawyer. It's just an example. That has changed since then, and they haven't gone back. The legislation has not gone back to what it was before, despite the attacks in Paris. But there is not the same expectation in France for civil liberties and the defense rights of people that have been taken into custody. However, there is a huge, I wouldn't say a lobby in the pejorative sense of the term, of the rights of people who have been arrested to adequate counsel. And I think a lot of what was coming out of France with regard to Gitmo, that's what you were hearing. There were a number of French lawyers, and I'm wondering if Bill ever ran into them, who were defending detainees in Gitmo at the time, pro bono. So I think that there's there's a huge gap in between expectations in France and French society as to what civil liberties will be protected by within France and what goes on outside the world. Now, with regard to the criticism of France or the French people, because I don't know that the government, and I wouldn't know this, but you pulled me into this as someone on the ground, and I'm just a private practitioner, so I have no contact with any official messages that were sent between the two governments. There was a lot of concern about torture, and I am not in a position to say whether it happened or didn't happen and what the definition of torture is or is not. Because that's not my area of practice, and there are others on this call who are much more qualified to speak to that than I am. But what you were hearing was criticism about the techniques that were used to, or attempted to be used, to get information through torture. And that was very intense in France over that. And I do think it was, to a large extent, a historical allergic reaction to what happened in Algeria, for those who are old enough to remember. But there was sort of a DNA rejection of the word torture, or torturing prisoners or detainees and that sort of thing. Now, with regard to the legislation, France is under a state of emergency. They can go into your home anytime they want. They can take whatever they want. They can hold you for a number of days, but you do have access to counsel after 4 hours, no matter who you are, no matter what they're accusing you of. They also have a special list of people under a letter, the S letter, which stands for security, which only certain people have access to. They were talking about house arrest for these people, even though they hadn't been accused of any crimes. There is rampant wire tapping. There is no FISA court that would, you know, authorize or not authorize wire tapping. And you know, that kind of legislation, people do not get upset about, but they expect that from France. I mean, the French people do not expect to have much security on their phone lines. They're completely paranoid about people looking at their phone bills and what numbers were called. And so I think we're comparing, in a sense, apples to oranges. If you want to go back to the 2003 invasion of Iraq, I think that's a very political question, and whatever decision was made not to join with the United States, I'm not in a position to say why they decided that, but I think after the fact it became fairly obvious that they didn't have confidence in the intelligence that was shared with them. But I think France was always more of a police state, if I can use that term, than the United States ever was. And I think it will continue to be more of a police state than the United States will ever be. And I think that's part of a cultural divide that we just have to take into consideration when you look at, when you talk about reactions and cooperation and that sort of thing. But again, I don't work for the government, so I don't, and I've never been a diplomat, as you can probably tell. So I don't know what the diplomats are talking about amongst themselves in terms of exchange of intelligence between the two countries. I do know, as a last comment, though, that on the European level, and particularly with respect to the terrorists that came from Belgium to France to commit the terrible terrorist attacks that took place in November 2015, they regretted, everyone was really very regretful that there had not been more intelligence sharing between at least Belgium and France. And now, somewhat due to our current U.S. president's remarks about NATO, there is a lot of talk or written articles and news accounts concerning the security of Europe or the European Union as a whole, and whether or not they should beef up the intelligence sharing. They have started to do that, and there's even been discussions, I don't know how far along they are, I suspect they're very, very preliminary, on setting up a European army to in the event that the United States pulls out of NATO. So I will end it there. I'm happy to discuss with our colleagues once we all finish. I don't know if that answers your question, Adam, but I hope I at least attempted to answer it.
Well, it certainly provided an awful lot of information. Thank you, Sally. It's a lot for us to consider, both as we move forward with this call and beyond. And if we can move to our career ambassador, and for the information of those listening on the call, career ambassador is actually a rank in the State Department equivalent to a four-star general in the Defense Department. So he is an ambassador's ambassador. Ambassador Crocker, can we start out at the general level, 30,000 foot level? What conditions would form the basis for a productive partnership between United States, either at the whole government level or agency level, and what hinders that? Let's set the set the general parameters of how can we have productive relationships with foreign partners and what might interfere?
Well, thanks, Adam. I should say that I'm here at LaGuardia Airport, and I apologize in advance for the ambient noise, but it actually kind of puts things in perspective. I was aboard one of the last passenger flights to land at LaGuardia on 9/11, and watched the Trade Center buildings go down from the Queensboro Bridge. We are light years beyond where we were then in terms of sharing among agencies at all levels, our competencies. I mean, we put a lot of money into this, but standing here today at LaGuardia, I'm very pleased and proud and relieved over what we've done to keep America safe. Look, on the issue of partnerships, it's a complicated issue. You kind of have to evaluate your relationship with each country under consideration. With some countries, of course, Australia, Canada, UK, we have incredibly close cooperation. With other countries, for a variety of reasons that can come into play, maybe not so much. So you got to analyze that. And then particularly in a gray area, and I spent my professional life living in a very gray world, few blacks and whites, figure out where interests may coincide. I'll give you one example. Iran, after 9/11, we conducted not a covert dialogue with the Iranians, but a quiet one. I led that effort in the last months of 2001. We could actually work with them on terrorism from Afghanistan because we shared a common interest, getting rid of the Taliban. So even with a country with whom we have not had diplomatic relations since 1979, under certain circumstances, you can cooperate on matters such as terrorism. And we did from basically September 2001 up to State of the Union 2002 that labeled Iran as part of the axis of evil. So again, you've got to be agile, you've got to be nimble, you've got to understand with whom you're dealing, what their goals are, and then look for possible intersections. So terrorism is everybody's problem. So you can differentially conduct relations, even with adversaries. But again, you got to know what they want. You got to know what you want.
So, there, Ambassador Crocker, on following up on that, I imagine it's not far-fetched to say that there often is a disconnect of sorts between public dialogue and private, you know, private diplomatic negotiations. It's the nature of diplomacy that pragmatism in terms of nations' mutual interests, you know, factor in the public dialogue and politics of a matter, but don't necessarily depend on it. But with things like, you know, Bill was talking about difficulties in getting evidence to prosecute via military commissions. And I suppose a slightly different angle on that is that Gitmo in some senses has been so radioactive that whenever you see a news story on it to this day, almost without exception, they use photos from Camp X-Ray in January of 2002 when that camp was open for a number of days. How important is symbolism and domestic politics, I guess, in public dialogue when you're engaging in private negotiations with interests that should perhaps transcend those things?
Well, Adam, it's a great question. We are a democracy, the world's greatest democracy, in my view. Public opinion matters. So, you know, the one thing that you can't do, I think, if you are a government official speaking officially, you can't lie. You know, that's devastating to a government's credibility with its own people. Now, that doesn't mean you have to tell everybody everything, but you know, you've got to have a coherent public diplomacy strategy, not least with the American people. So it is an important part of it. In terms of partnerships, I would just echo what Bill Leetsaw said. They're critical. You know, you can't do it alone. And this is not something I was directly involved in, but it often makes a world of difference if you approach traditional allies, for example, in Europe, and say, okay, here's what we're doing, here's why we're doing it, here's the legal underpinning of it. You know, how does that sound to you? And to, you know, bring them into the conversation. You know, we were in uncharted territory. We'd never had an enemy like this over a prolonged period. So, you know, listening to the opinions of allies and others costs you nothing. It can take you to a better form of partnership. Everybody likes to be consulted. And then you you take it from there.
Bill, likewise, on, you know, on Gitmo specific stuff, I think it's a great example. You know, Ambassador Crocker notes that you know, we're a diplomacy, we're a democracy, and certainly you know, the U.S. government has a fiduciary duty of sorts to the American people. But when it comes to your experience in working with foreign counterparts on detention related issues, did you see any trends or general observations about where there might have been a breakdown among foreign government personnel between what they were telling you about detention matters versus public statements coming out of those same countries?
Sure, and I think that there absolutely were. That's a great point and question. I think just kind of taking a step beyond what Ambassador Crocker just said, where he said how important it was to listen to our allies and partners, I think it's important to note that that doesn't necessarily mean just do what they say. I think in many cases what we did, for instance, in Guantanamo, where we kind of ran off to say we were going to close it or end law of war detention as if it was some sort of a violation of the rule of law, I don't think that was the right answer, even though there had been a lot of criticism of Guantanamo. What had really happened was there was not a lot of dialogue to explain it back and forth. And I've unfortunately seen that too many times. And in the case of Guam, it is a good example. We ran into that with our NATO forces in Afghanistan, or more than just NATO. We had one time had, I don't know what, we had at least a coalition of 45 countries at some point fighting the Taliban and al-Qaeda, and perhaps larger. I'm just not reflecting anything larger right now. But at that time, I do remember the detention policies that were in place for many of our allies. They varied across the spectrum. And NATO finally adopted a policy that you could not hold anyone for more than 96 hours. Eventually, the European Court of Human Rights came up with some rulings that basically put a lot of our allies into a difficult position because they were interpreting all of the rights and the civil liberties that somebody would have in a detention situation as being founded in human rights law, which would be a peacetime body of law that wouldn't really work in an armed conflict. And so we had these various policies that essentially allowed, for instance, an enemy terrorist or insurgent to be killed by one of our allies, but couldn't really be captured unless you were able to prosecute them. On the other hand, the United States would end up detaining people and could detain people for a lengthier period of time, which was frankly more consistent with an armed conflict. But the problem is the discussion hadn't taken place early on in the process. So people were criticizing our detention, not just for torture, but for even the very existence of a detention without a subsequent prosecution. And we had not early on taken the time to have that discussion to explain that sometimes countries just deal with things differently. You know, internal to a country, there are the civil rights and civil liberties issues that Sally talked about with respect to France, a state of emergency, and more of a police state. And that's a direction the United States could have headed in after 9/11. Instead, we moved into an armed conflict, and we made it clear that whatever loss of civil rights and civil liberties would be a temporary circumstance dictated by the armed conflict. That armed conflict has gone on for a heck of a long time now, and so there needs to be another discussion about how do we look at the end of that. But what we really need to do is have clarity with our allies so that we understand the way each of us looks at it in our own domestic systems and looks at these issues so that we can recognize as we come up with our own policies that, one, we're coming up with policies that will work domestically for us, but we're also coming up with policies that will allow us to cooperate better as partners, recognizing that each of us sees things a little bit differently.
I'd like to just say one thing here. When I was speaking about France, I can only echo and agree with what you've just said, Bill. I obviously don't know what went on between the two countries prior to or during the discussions about Gitmo, but what I do know is that the criticism that was coming from Europe, including France, but not only France, was perceived as a violation of the Geneva agreements. And therefore, your statement that the communications were not clear whether or not it was a state of war or civil liberties, human rights law, I think it is quite right. And I think that that's a problem because the communications were not clear at all. And the problem is that people did not understand what the purpose of Gitmo was, whether it was a prison in terms of a state of war, or whether or not it was a violation of civil liberties. So I think that could have been done much better, but you know, hindsight is always foresight, right? Anyway, back to you.
Sally, I not to put you on the spot and cast this in too broad and vague a terms, but you know, despite the criticisms coming from Europe and from the French, the U.S. has prided itself for many, many years on being the leader of the free world. And do you think, anecdotally from your being there for so long, do the Europeans, do the French believe that still to be true? And do they continue to value the relationship and partnerships that they have with the United States on these and other issues?
I would say yes, up until the election, the presidential election in the United States. I think there's a real concern of what kind of relationship can or should be established with the new government. That hasn't been an easy road. I suspect that at some point things will calm down, or at least I hope they will. At this point, France is now having its presidential election, so it's a little bit difficult to say what direction they're going into. I mean, we will all remember after World War II, de Gaulle took France out of NATO. So there is that protectionism and nationalism and populism that's going on in France. I think a great deal of the perception of the United States as leader of the free world, I don't think anyone is that in Europe, including what we used to call Eastern Europe, would say that that's still true wholeheartedly and without reserves. I think we've lost a lot of credibility in Europe since January 20th. And I hope that will be a thing of the past as soon as things calm down in Washington. But America, as a leader of the free world, I think has taken a hit philosophically and politically. So I couldn't say yes to respond to your question.
Well, let's leave plenty of time to open the floor for audience questions. I think we've got about 25 minutes left in the call. And Laura, I want to first thank our speakers for everything that they've discussed so far. And Laura, back to you.
Great. Let's go to audience questions. In a moment, you'll hear a prompt indicating that the floor mode has been turned on. After that, to request the floor, enter star, then the pound key. When we get to your request, you will hear a prompt, and then you may ask your question. We will answer questions in the order in which they are received. Again, to ask a question, please enter star, then the pound key on your telephone keypad. Not seeing any questions, I'll make a brief announcement. Our next telephone conference call is scheduled for next Tuesday, March 14th. That call will explore accelerating financial inclusion and inclusive growth, and will feature Shamina Singh, President of the MasterCard Center for Inclusive Growth. Again, to ask a question, please enter star, then the pound key on your telephone keypad. I don't see any questions, Adam, so if you have another question for our panelists.
Sure. Recognizing that the intelligence profession is separate from diplomacy, is separate from defense, is certainly separate from private practice, wondering if any of you care to opine on to the extent that there is foreign government criticism of U.S. programs, whether it be interrogation or signals, that part and parcel of the partnerships that we have, the security partnerships that we have, despite the criticism, in your opinion, and maybe I'll direct this first to Ambassador Crocker. Do they seem to still want the info?
Yes, they do. And as we saw, tragically, after the attacks in Paris and Brussels, there was a tremendous amount of back and forth between agencies here and agencies there. We offered, publicly to support their efforts in any way we could. So whatever lingering feelings there may have been about Iraq, we're in a new place now. And that I think everybody in Europe understands that. And they clearly value the resources and expertise that we bring to such a discussion.
If I can jump in,
it's got great press. I mean, from a just a commoner point of view, it was very clear, at least in France, that the United States was more than cooperative in sharing information. I mean, there didn't seem to be any leftover, as Ambassador Crocker said, any leftover hard feelings over 2003 at all. But you never know what goes on behind the scenes, right? Sorry, go back to you, Adam.
Or whoever else wants to comment.
Yeah, Adam, if I could just jump in on that as well. I think your question about intelligence is a really good one in terms of an area where, even though you're generally talking about domestic law here as guiding your own intelligence agencies, you're not usually looking at an international law violation. Well, not necessarily looking at a violation at all, but this is an area where our partnership and our own domestic laws really come into play, because our ability to share is a domestic law issue. Other countries' ability to share is a domestic law issue. And then the protection of the intelligence that we do share can sometimes be a domestic law issue, and that gets influenced by the perceptions. For instance, again, I'm using the Guantanamo example because it comes up. You know, many people are well aware that all the former Guantanamo detainees from the United Kingdom are quite wealthy now because of a lawsuit against the UK government, in which the UK government settled the lawsuit, because for a brief period of time in the UK, their domestic law was situated such that it could permit the revelation of intelligence information from another country. That would obviously severely harm a country's ability to get intelligence from one of its allies if there was a risk that it could be publicly disclosed in a trial. So they had to take action to prevent that from happening, despite a domestic law that could have allowed it. So that's something we just need to – that's really a great example of where it cuts across all the bodies of law. You can't just worry about the fundamental human rights law from an international law perspective. You got to look at how different countries are applying it in their domestic law too, and it makes it a lot more complicated.
Is that I'd like to ask a question to Bill. Is that generally done when an analysis is made? I mean, do you go into and see what's going on in the domestic laws before you make a request?
I think when we set up our intelligence sharing, and I'm not part of the intelligence community, but when we set up our intelligence sharing relationships, we certainly would look into that. But in a case like this, domestic law in the United Kingdom changed in the midstream.
Right.
So when determinations were made and then the law changes, countries have to decide what they're going to do to mitigate any harm from that.
Exactly. I mean, that's not anybody's fault when the domestic law changes. We just have to adapt, right?
Well, it's the fault of the people who changed it, perhaps. But, yeah.
Well, I don't know that they always change the law just to deprive the United States of intelligence or vice versa. There are always more complicated situations. But who knows?
Yeah, this is Ryan Crocker. If I could jump in here. I was the U.S. ambassador to Pakistan 2004-2007, and then back to Afghanistan 2011-2012. So in Pakistan under the George W. Bush administration, Afghanistan under the Obama administration. When President Obama came into office, one of the first things he did was to stop all renditions. We weren't going to do that anymore. An unintended consequence of that is, or was, that if you're not going to have renditions anymore, if the Pakistanis, under their law, can't incarcerate Al-Qaeda operatives, also their politics, quite frankly, it means you only got one choice. You don't have the choice between capture and kill. Just kill. I'm not quite sure that was thought through carefully when the Obama administration made that decision.
Great example.
I'll make another call for questions. Again, to ask a question, please enter star, then the pound key on your telephone keypad. A reminder to keep an eye out for emails announcing upcoming teleforum calls, and you can also consult the full schedule of our teleforum conference calls on the Federalist Society's website, fedsoc.org. Also available there are podcasts of previously recorded teleforum calls you may have missed. Again, to ask a question, please enter star, then the pound key on your telephone keypad.
Going back.
Go ahead.
I'm standing here at LaGuardia, and two New York State troopers just walked by. One of them carrying an M16 in addition to his sidearm. That makes me feel good all over. We are not the nation we were on September 10, 2001.
Well, that's interesting that you said that, because the French police have between the army and the police are always walking around with arms that I can't identify as well as you just did. It doesn't make me feel safe at all. It makes me crazy, because I'm afraid they're going to trip and kill somebody with their arms, but that's just me. And we really have a very heavy armed police presence, and I don't know that, maybe it makes some people feel better. It doesn't make me feel better. I just don't think they're going to stop whatever needs to be stopped by walking around with arms like that. But I've been out of the country for a long time. Maybe I'm just not used to it. But I'm glad you feel better.
I do.
Yeah.
This actually comes off the partnerships topic just a little bit. And Ambassador, I noticed during my time in Iraq, it seemed as though the natural tendency of successive, say, RSOs, regional security officers, for those listening, the top security official, law enforcement official in an embassy, especially in an environment that you would have in Iraq, Afghanistan, Pakistan, that there is never any incentive in the threat environment that we face to ever relax security restrictions. That, God forbid something were to happen on your watch and you had taken if you had drawn down your posture, then there's no benefit to you. How do we avoid kind of a feedback effect of tighter and tighter and tighter security measures initiated by successive individuals who take on these leadership posts who want to make sure that nothing happens on their watch?
That's a great question, Adam. One, of course, that I've had some direct experience with. When ambassadors are sent to post, they are given a letter from the president, sort of general instruction. The typical text starts out saying something like, your primary responsibility is the security and safety of the people under your authority. Trumps everything else. So when I was shown that letter, as I was on my way to Baghdad, I said, no. I'm going into a war. In a war, you don't have your primary responsibility being the security and safety of your people. That's just dumb. So they dropped it. That made my security officers a whole lot more relaxed and much more ready to entertain a reasonable risk. We did the same thing in Afghanistan. Sadly, we lost people on my watch in both countries, but that's the price of diplomacy in a war zone. You've got to take risks. So, that's one. The second thing we've done is we've gotten smart about developing our security officers. They get now language training, which didn't used to be available to them. So, you know, if you got a security officer in Afghanistan who speaks Pashto, if you've got a security officer in Pakistan who speaks Urdu, they're going to be a lot more valuable and a lot more comfortable because they'll understand the environment that much better.
Bringing this full circle back to partnerships, how much can you rely on and trust, you know, the security apparatus of the country to, you know, in which our mission is based? So, obviously, there have been for many years questions about relying on Pakistani security forces in particular, and certainly in Afghanistan too. You know, Afghanistan police forces or people posing as Afghani police forces potentially mm-hmm. attacking U.S. personnel. I mean, how do those partnerships and necessary symbiotic relationships, you know, prove fruitful, and where do they become dangerous?
Well, that's all part of the gray area that you live in if you're working for the U.S. government overseas. Again, you know, knowledge of the local situation is imperative. You just have to have the ability to make a clear-eyed assessment of capabilities and even loyalties. So in a place like Pakistan, we were quite careful. At the same time, my security detail was led by an American. You know, she rode in the front seat of my limo. But the rest of the detail were Pakistanis, very carefully vetted, and on long-term detail to us. I had every bit of confidence in them. But you just got to, you know, pay attention to your local environment. Know the country, know the people. That's why language is so important. You know, there is no cookie cutter response, at least not a good one. So it's all partnerships are based on relationships. It's you know, just one of those things you got to drill down on.
I think that's a great point possibly to end on, unless there are any questions from the floor, that, you know, partnerships based on relationships. There are many different aspects to consider in forming these relationships, many practical, pragmatic national interests at stake, especially in the counterterrorism field, but also domestic, you know, political ramifications that can also inform the foreign policy and international relations aspect of things. So unless there are other comments that our speakers are itching to make and make concluding remarks, and unless Laura has any questions on the line, I thank you all.
Thank you.
Thank you, Adam, for doing this. It was an honor to be part of it. Thank you.
On behalf of the Federalist Society, I want to thank our experts for the benefit of their valuable time and expertise today. We welcome listener feedback by email at info@fedsoc.org. Thank you all for joining us. We are adjourned.
Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this Practice Group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at fedsoc.org/multimedia.